Good evening, everybody, and welcome back. I hope that you've all enjoyed the refreshments. So we're on to the next leg of this evening's event, and my talk is about Dharma in daily life. So this aspect of Dharma in daily life is actually a key focus that we need to clarify, and I'd like to use this evening to share with you what it means. For some Buddhists themselves, they might actually get the definition, or they have a slight misconception about what it means to apply Dharma in their daily life. So, how should Buddhists spend their time? In our daily lives, how should we actually spend it? When you think about a Buddhist monk or a nun, what image comes to your mind? The first thing is, you wouldn't expect them to carry a laptop bag and walk around in the Big Apple. We got quite a lot of stares as we were walking down Park Avenue coming here. But this is not just something, native or weird for Americans and New Yorkers. In Asia, this is also quite a big issue, because a lot of people in Asia, even though they regard themselves as Buddhist, they're not fully practicing. And so their idea and concept of what it means to apply Buddhism in daily life pretty much comes from what their parents told them, and more often than not, what they watch in the movies and what is portrayed in the movies. And so that can also be a bit misleading as well. But one thing is for sure is they think that as monks and nuns, we spend our time either somewhere deep in the forest, away from sight and just sitting in meditation, or we're deep in the sutras, so we lock ourselves away in the library of the monastery and just spend the whole day a bookworm, in this case a sutra worm. Or they think that we should be there performing ceremonies for the deceased. And this is one thing I find very common, is when I meet people, it's usually because there's a death in the family. And when a death occurs, they think, that's what that nun's for. And they'll come and look and say, what do I do now? How do I deal with the ceremonies and so forth? So, yes, we do help people, with these issues, but that's not what we do first and foremost. So they actually get shocked when, in Australia, when they see me go grocery shopping. So it's like, what? You actually eat? You have to go and buy groceries? So, apart from that, there are also misconceptions regarding lay Buddhist. Now, some people think that, well, if I'm Buddhist, I have to be vegetarian. Or they think I have to attend service ceremonies all the time, repentance ceremonies, chanting ceremonies, and so forth. Or they feel they have to make a lot of donations to the monasteries or help with repair jobs and building works, especially in Asia. And they also think that, oh, as a Buddhist, I have to do a lot of charity work. All the above are good, but it depends on your motivation. Why are you actually doing this? Some people attend service ceremonies not for the practice, but because there's free lunch. Some people attend because it's just a fun day out with friends, and because all my friends are going there, well, I guess I have to go there as well. So the motivation is not so proper and correct. Now, some people feel that they have to make donations. It's good if you try to help with the propagation of the Dharma, the maintenance of the monasteries and all that. But again, some people do it in a way that it's really to boost their own ego. Some would say, I paid for the gold guild on that 100-meter Buddha statue. And then someone else would say, well, I paid for the paving of the road all the way. So then it just becomes this competition, who gave the most. But really, it's not about how much you give and what you give, it's why you give. So bear that in mind. All these activities, definitely I would encourage, you know, eat more vegetarian food if you're not vegetarian yet. But there's nothing wrong if you can't be vegetarian. My mum says there's no way she can be vegetarian. She loves her steak. So I said, that's fine. But eat more vegetarian, attend service ceremonies if you want to learn a bit more of the ritualistic side of things. That's all part of learning about Buddhism. But do all of these activities with good intentions, with proper intentions. For a true follower of Buddhism and one who practices, their aim is to discipline and purify their own body and mind, and ultimately to attain the wholesome outcome of liberation of the body and mind. So this is from the angle of the individual practitioner. When we present Buddhist teachings and Dharma talks, sometimes you might see or get conflicting messages. You need to understand where we're coming from. And in this particular aim is from the individual's practice point of view. What do you want to get out of applying Buddhism in your daily life? So remember this particular aim, to discipline and purify our own body and mind. So when we talk about body and mind, we're talking about the activities of the body and mind led by consciousness. So this is referring to intentional deeds. And these deeds and activities can be towards oneself, it can be towards other people and other beings, and it can also be towards the external world. So things referring to activities and mental or physical towards oneself is when you think about what dress should I wear, should I go to the gym, do I need to lose weight and so forth. You know, these are all directing to yourself. If it's towards other people and beings, it might be, oh, it's mum's birthday, what should I get her? Or it's Christmas time, oh no, I haven't done my Christmas shopping. So these are all directed to other people. And it could be to other beings, you know, if you have a pet. Like I have a lot of farm animals around me, so I always think, well, what else can I get them? I've got some extra veggies, I'll just dice it up and give it to them. So that's towards other beings as well. And then you've got to the external world. This refers more to the external environment, more from the materialistic view. So all this movement for recycling, to help improve the environment, cleaning up your house, cleaning up your bedroom, that's also an aspect of it. So all things body and mind refers to intentional, conscious deeds and acts. Now, when we talk about discipline and purifying, discipline here is referring to control. Now, this control is not a dictatorial type of control. Rather, it is to guide our every thought and actions with wisdom. So this discipline is that we carry ourselves using wisdom. We think about what we do before we actually do it. And purify refers to develop wholesomeness, to develop wholesomeness or to develop virtues, and to actively tame and hopefully to eliminate our vices as well. So that's what we mean by discipline and purify. So how do we determine what is wholesome, which we must do, which we should do, and what is unwholesome, which we must not do? Now, have you ever thought about this? How do you determine? When I ask people this, they will often say, well, if it's moral, then it's wholesome. But then the question becomes, what is moral? I'd like to share with you the teachings from the Dharma, which I think are quite self-explanatory and a very good guide. Again, we go back to the aspect of benefiting oneself and others. So if your act does not benefit you and it does not benefit others, then it's not wholesome. And it's really something we should refrain from doing. So there's a must not do, and it's in grey. Then you get to the aspect of selfish acts, where you gain benefit, but it's at the cost of someone else. So it's at someone else's cost, or it may inadvertently bring harm to others. So this goes back to the discipline aspect of wisdom. You think more carefully about whether this benefits me and does it harm others. If it does, it's still not wholesome, and it's something that we shouldn't do as well. So the reverse is that if it doesn't benefit me, but it benefits others, then this is a case where you sacrifice something to help others. You give up some of your time, you give up some of your financial resources, you can give up some of your knowledge, you share your knowledge. 'Cause I know that I remember back in university when we had an assignment and we all would charge to the library, and you'd find that some of the books have been borrowed already. And those people, once they borrow it, they just keep renewing and keep renewing until the end of the assignment time. So no one else has access to those journals. You know, so in this case, if you know that you need to sacrifice something, but it does bring benefit to others, then try to do it if you can. If it's within your means, if you can do it, and it doesn't cause you too much grief and angst, then try and do it. But if the sacrifice is too much, then you can refrain from doing it. But at this point in time, you can still make the wish and say, hopefully in future I will have the courage to do it. In future may I have the capacity to do this. And so the last one is the win-win situation in which you should do it. Or as Nike would say, just do it. So if there's benefit to you and benefit to others and there's absolutely no harm to anyone, then why not? Why not do it? You know, it'll just make everything much better. So this is a very simple way to gauge whether you should or shouldn't do something. And it's also a way that you can rationally think about things when you're tempted to do something that you shouldn't, or when you're too lazy to do something that you should. So I hope this gives you a bit more guidance and a bit more assistance when you come to crossroads in your life to making decisions. Now I'd like to turn the focus to two key virtues. This virtue of impartiality and affection for all beings. These two virtues are quite important in being able to apply this aim to discipline and purify our own body and mind. These two key virtues are also the supports, the foundations upon which we can then go further to develop the Bodhi vow. And that is the following talk by the Dean, Venerable Zanzi. So let's look at impartiality first. Now, what this means is that towards all sentient beings, we should maintain an attitude, a view, or a perception of impartiality and non-discrimination. So what this means is that we're not denying the manifested differences, all right? I do look different to you. You are taller than me. We're not denying these manifestations of differences, but what we want is to go beyond gender, to go beyond skin colour and race and so on. We look beyond these differences to recognise that no one is really better or worse. And there really is no true, permanent, unchanging difference upon which we can actually discriminate. As you may or may not know, in Buddhism, impermanence is a universal truth. So everything can change. I mean, heaven forbids, you know, your president in the next life might be Mexican. Who knows? Or even worse, Chinese. So everything can change, you know. The Buddha teaches us that the manifested differences we see are a result of the causes and conditions that prevail now. So we have this diversity. But Buddhism also teaches us that there are three life cycles. So that means we have past lives, this present life, and we will have future lives. So when we take this broader view, which encompasses countless lives, our interaction with all beings are sure to include both good and bad relations. So in this sense, we would have been close to all beings and have also been enemies with them at one time or another. So let us think about this a little bit more. We take, for example, the aspects of good and evil. Even the most evil person, believe it or not, would have carried out some good deeds in the past. Moreover, they are not permanently evil. On the other hand, a good person would have also done some bad deeds in the past, and it's not certain if they will remain a good person in the future. And we can even see this in the stories of the great bodhisattvas. Some people will not realize it, but if we take, for example, Manjushri Bodhisattva, there's a very clear example. So, in the story of one of Manjushri's past life, this bodhisattva, as we know him now, is regarded as foremost in wisdom. But in one of his past lives, he didn't believe the teachings on emptiness when he heard about them. And as a result, he behaved very badly towards that particular bodhisattva that was teaching about emptiness. And he even declared that those teachings are false. So in Buddhism, when you declare true teachings to be false, we say you're defaming the Dharma. And as a result of this, it is recorded in the sutras that he fell into the hells for many, many lifetimes. But this encounter with the true teachings on emptiness also served as the cause which allowed him to later develop true wisdom and great wisdom for what he is renowned today. So in this particular example, we already have both wise and stupid and good and evil. So if we reflect and contemplate in such a manner repeatedly, then all concepts of differences such as enemy versus family, wise versus stupid, good versus evil will naturally and gradually subside as we begin to look beyond the narrow framework of just this particular life. So remember and take note, we're not saying you muddle things up and you ignore what the differences are. You know, we're not saying you ignore good and bad. But what we're saying is that we should be aware in this present life, given the conditions that are prevailing, we should be aware of what it means. But we also bear in mind the broader picture, the complete picture covering past and future lives. And with that, the aim is to change our personal, habitual, discriminative nature. And this discriminative nature, which focuses heavily on ourselves, is something that has accrued since beginningless time. So only by trying to develop this attitude of impartiality, to develop this virtue of impartiality, we can then slowly be able to treat all beings equally and favourably. So in this sense, we should understand that although there are manifested differences, there really is no actual or true basis for discrimination between family and foe. And as a result, there's no need to be arrogant. You may be very smart, you may be very wealthy in this life or at this moment, but things can change. And there's no need to feel inferior if your predicament now is not so good. Because when impermanence happens, it can be a good thing. So when we also understand the value of developing this virtue of impartiality, we'll also start to know that there's no need to develop strong attachment to those that show us a lot of kindness, nor should we develop strong aversion to those that treat us poorly. So, of course, here I'd like to mention, if you're facing harm, if someone is going to hurt you, then you recognise your danger and you try to save yourself, protect yourself. You get yourself out of the situation, but at least try not to hold hatred towards them, because holding hatred towards them is a burden on yourself. Whether or not that person will be affected, you don't know, but definitely you will. So protect yourself if need be, but try not to hold hatred. When you're able to maintain this equal and calm mental state, this is what we're referring to as impartiality. Now, once impartiality is firmly established, we can overcome our biased conceptions. When we overcome these, we'll also be able to free ourselves from obsessive love and deep hatred. So I've mentioned the word love here, and you might think, what's wrong with love? Isn't it a good thing? This is not necessarily so if you follow the Buddha Dharma's understanding and perspective. The reason being is that ordinary love, even if it brings some joy to others, it's still narrow and selfish. And so if we take all sentient beings into account, this narrow and selfish love may actually bring more harm than benefits. Where there is love, there's hatred. You might think, no, I don't agree. But if you look at it, in the Buddha's teachings, love and hatred may seem like extreme opposites, but we are taught that they are in fact the different faces of the one defilement. What this means is that where you see there is love, very often hatred can arise as a result of that. And a clear example is in marriage and divorce. So a couple can love each other so much they commit to living together. But when things go pear-shaped, the divorce can get very ugly. And I've been looking, reading on some of the news and so forth, and it's almost like, shockingly, every day you hear about couples during the breakup, one couple takes the kids, murder-suicide, just for revenge on the partner. If that love wasn't there in the first place, would that hatred be there? So that's what we're trying to say here, where we say that this type of ordinary love, this type of selfish love and hatred are actually the two faces of the one affliction. In Buddhism, what we try to promote is great compassion, and this great compassion is impartial. In order to develop this, we must first slowly learn to abandon this defiled love. And only when we are able to let go of this defiled, clinging, worldly type of a love, we can start to develop universally the empathy for all beings, and therefore the willingness to offer relief to all beings. This is the aspiration that we hold dear, and I hope that this is the aspiration you can also hold dear. You don't have to be a Buddhist to hold this aspiration. It's good. It's just a very good humanitarian virtue. So with this virtue of impartiality, it helps us to break through our ingrained discrimination so that we are able to view ourselves and sentient beings equally and in the same way, without hatred and without biased love. But this does not mean we view them as completely unrelated, because the English word of impartiality sometimes can have a very cold notion to it. And that's why we have the second key virtue, which is affection for all sentient beings. Now, to understand why we must also have this second virtue, impartiality can be, for some people, it can be just neither liking or disliking. So it's very cold. But when we then combine that impartiality with an affection for all sentient beings, we add warmth to it. And this warmth is to help us develop a harmonious and amiable relationship towards all sentient beings. So this affection for all beings is not the same as selfish love. Instead, it's a joyous attitude that we hold towards all beings, but there's no attachments to it. And as I said, impartiality alone is not enough to help us accomplish great wisdom and great compassion. That's why we need this affection for all sentient beings. To help you understand this a bit more, does this look familiar? Imagine when you think back to when you made your way over to this event, all the people you passed by on the streets, the elderly, the young, the males and the females, you know, the good looking and the not so good looking. Impartiality for some people could mean I neither hate them or I neither like them. So it's like, yes, it's impartial and it's treating them equally, but this discrimination is not, this non-discrimination, this impartiality is unable to help us exert a positive influence to make us want to help others and to do things for others. So that's why we also need this affection for all sentient beings. So this affection for all sentient beings helps to support the virtue of impartiality. And what it means is we try to nurture a concern for all beings, nurture a sense of harmony that has vitality and motivates us to want to help others. So bear in mind these thoughts. When you come across situations, you think, how can I help? What can I do to help? Constantly have these in your mind as situations arise and take whatever actions you can to help. If you can't, because of whatever reason you're, whatever situation you're in at present, then as I said before, make good wishes, you know, wish them well. If you see people that are sick and you have no way of helping them, you can still, I wish that they can regain good health soon, or I wish they gain the medical care that they need. Send out kindness, send out compassion. That will also help as well. It helps you nurture this want to help. It helps you nurture this virtue to have concern for sentient beings. So after working to establish the foundation of impartiality and then combining that with an affection for all sentient beings, it's extremely important that we bear these in mind, because these two are what allows us to progress further. So having these two virtues already can make us a much better person. But these two are only the basic prerequisites to the even greater goal of the Bodhi vow. So I do wish that you can let these virtues become a part of you, and to let these virtues guide your thoughts, actions, behaviours, and so on, so that if you do decide to develop the Bodhi vow, and I hope you do after the next talk, then you'll be in good stead to both be a true asset to your family, your friends, and to this society and the world. So thank you.